This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Hello, my name is Mark Hayes, and it's my pleasure as Secretary of PKSG to welcome you to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. On the 26th of October 2010, our guest was Professor Charles Goodhart of the London School of Economics, who spoke on the topic of the financial crisis and the future of macroeconomics, with a response from Michael Kaczynski of Pembroke College, Cambridge. You can download slides to accompany the talk from the PKSG website. Enjoy listening.
Thank you very much, Mark. I've got a bad cold, so I hope that I don't come silent as a result of a sore throat halfway through. But anyhow, we'll try. Now, since this is a Keynes seminar, I'd like to go back and look at a bit of the history of thought over my lifetime, since the general theory came out in the year that I was born. I didn't read it for some time afterwards. In the general theory, Keynes talked about effective aggregate demand and how it interacted with aggregate supply, and the supply side had a reverse L shape in the form that prices were generally constant until you came to full employment, and when you came to full employment you couldn't increase the usage of the factors of production. And therefore, if demand should rise above the full employment level, it would have to be cut off by an increase in prices or inflation. Now, a lot of people have argued that Keynes's theory was a rather special theory that depended on wage and price stickiness, because otherwise you would have wages declining sufficiently so that the Pigou effect would lead to a restoration of full employment. I think that criticism, in effect, is inappropriate for a number of reasons. The first and possibly the least important reason, but one that I think would have had an effect on anyone who was living in the interwar period, is that if you excluded the wartime periods, particularly World War I, Napoleonic War, and other periods of wartime, the experience both of the UK and of most other developed countries was that in normal times prices were constant. So that if you took the price level in 1816 and you took the price level in 1913, they were pretty much the same. There was a great deal of short-term volatility in prices, which in those days most of our economies were agricultural economies, and therefore you had large but temporary supply shocks due to weather and good and bad harvests, which were relatively random. But otherwise, prices were constant, so that apart from the particular example of wartime pressures, the norm, which everyone was used to at that stage, was that you could expect prices to be constant under all normal circumstances. I think analytically a more important point is that under most circumstances, the idea that you would get a huge immediate decline in prices, after which the expectations would be the prices would either stabilize or go back up again, was very unlikely. That because of the various rigidities in wage and price setting, that these were done not on a continuous basis, but occasionally for all kinds of informational and bargaining economies, meant that there would be a great deal of auto-regression in prices, so that you wouldn't get a single sudden decline in prices after which you might try and get to some kind of equilibrium. But that if you've got declining prices, you would have a period in which prices were and were expected to go on declining. Now, under those kind of conditions, which you can think of as being Japan over the last decade, the expectation that prices would continue to decline would, of course, mean that real interest rates would be much higher, and there would be an incentive for people actually to defer expenditures, so that the impact of an auto-regressive decline in prices would actually be contractionary or deflationary along the sort of the Irving Fisher type lines. So that the idea that there could be an instantaneous flexibility of prices which could get you out of an unemployment problem was very unlikely. I say very unlikely because it's not actually impossible. There have been some occasions in which, in conditions in which there has been external adverse shocks, there have been occasions in which price flexibility, wage and price flexibility, have been sufficient to restore competitiveness without there being necessarily a long-term, dragged-out, deflationary, expected auto-regressive decline in prices. There are two such occasions that I would bring to your attention, though they are pretty atypical, and they both occurred in very small economies under particular circumstances. The first was Singapore in the Southeast Asian crisis from 1997-98, when following the devaluations in Thailand, Indonesia and all that, there was a lot of pressure put on Singapore. And the authorities in Singapore, a very shall we say authoritarian, very well controlled but still a very controlled state, introduced a more or less universal 15% cut in everything, wages, prices, the lot, which had the result of actually bringing about a restoration in Singapore competitiveness and making Singapore much less prone to some of the deflationary pressures in Southeast Asia and a number of the other countries. I say that because I've actually just returned from Latvia, and the governor of the Central Bank of Latvia really came to see me in, I think it was 2008, and said, have there been any occasions on which there has been sufficient flexible wage price adjustment so that you could have an internal devaluation which would bring about a restoration of equilibrium at full employment when you can't control your own external exchange rate? The Latvians actually were able to control their external exchange rate to a degree, but their problem was that their banking and financial system had been such that almost all the loans outstanding were denominated in foreign currency, mostly in euro, with the result that had the Latvians actually devalued, the debt deflation burden on their households who'd taken out foreign currency mortgages and their corporates would have actually made things far worse. So they decided not to devalue. And the governor came along to talk to me and said, are there any examples of actually introducing a internal devaluation by wage price flexibility? And the Latvian example is actually one of the extremes. And in the case of 2009, I think their nominal GDP went down by over 20%. I don't know the exact details, of which something like about 10 and 15% was a price effect. The extent of the nominal deflation, the recovery of of competitiveness was sufficient that the Latvian economy, having been wildly uncompetitive and having been subject to an enormous credit expansion, has now turned the corner. But Latvia, again, is rather unusual. It's unusual because it's very small. It's only got 2.3 million people, and therefore a relatively small amount of foreign assistance from the European Union, the European Commission, and the IMF was sufficient to provide them with support to offset external speculation. Combined with the fact that the Latvian population had experienced in well within living memory vastly worse economic conditions under the Soviet Union, and had, since they had received independence in 1991, had had a really dramatic improvement in their living standards and conditions. So that the decline in output in 2008-2009, although wildly dramatic by Western standards, normal Western standards, simply brought their standard of living back to the kind of level that had existed in 2005-2006. And they still reported, reckoned that, those kinds of standards of living were much, much preferable and superior to what they had suffered under the dirigiste communist arrangement. Again, one of the interests here about how far can flexible prices and wages actually help you, particularly when you can't control your exchange rate. Ireland is going through this exactly that same kind of conditions now, in which wage price flexibility is trying to bring about an alternative to external exchange rate changes. Whereas the Irish at least haven't borrowed in foreign currency, unfortunately they borrowed in vast quantities from their own banks, who are now in extremely bad condition, and the attempt to bail these out is putting a huge burden on the fiscal position. So that the it's actually quite interesting that one of the questions that was raised in discussion of Keynesian analysis, which is how far can flexible wages prices get you out of a problem, how far was Keynesian analysis dependent on sticky wages prices, is actually a live topic of discussion, particularly in the peripheral European economies. Anyhow, all of this Keynesian analysis became, to some extent improperly, codified as ISLM by John Hicks and others. You all know about ISLM, and of course it left out a great deal of what Keynes really felt to be important, as people like Elaine Hooford and others have argued. Left out all of the concerns that Keynes had about the fact that the future is so uncertain that you cannot really assess what the probabilities are, you can't begin to, and therefore there is a huge importance for confidence and animal spirits. If you like, in more modern terms, for shifts in risk aversion from times when people feel that risk has gone way down, as they did during the boom years up to 2007. And then when there is a major change and a huge shock, as it was, where you get a complete reversal with risk aversion going right up. Now then, of course, we got the national income data, and this began to be provided during wartime to reinforce and provide guidance for the allocation of resources during wartime. And then, of course, one moved from the L-shaped supply curve to the Phillips curve in 1958, where instead of the L shape, you had this sloping relationship between unemployment and inflation, and that led to the assessment of the output gap as an influence on inflation. And then one got the national income models that developed in the 1960s, particularly with the development of computers. I left Cambridge in 1960 having never seen a computer. There were computers, but they were vast machines in huge buildings, and undergraduates would never get anywhere near them. For undergraduate purposes, they didn't exist. When I got to Cambridge, the first computer I saw had its output printer was in the form of a typewriter sitting atop one of these desks. And the keys went up and down sort of automatically, printing this stuff out. And those were the days that were developed of punch cards and all that, where you took this huge box of cards along to the computer, and if one of them was out of place, your whole of your day's work was completely wasted. And it took about 3 hours to do a sort of 4x4 matrix. It was a different world in those days, and as the computers began to come in, we were able to do much more in the way of modelling. I was in the Department of Economic Affairs and Treasury for a time between 64 and 66, and the national income models were being developed and constructed then. Wynne Godley was there and actually was doing a lot of the work, along with Jim Shepherd. And the technician econometrician who was working with him was a guy called Owen Nankerville. Now, anyhow, in these kinds of models, which were based on the application of Keynesian theory to national income data, the general line of policy management was that you used fiscal policy to adjust the economy, because the fiscal multipliers were thought to be relatively clear, whereas the interest elasticity of expenditures was thought to be very uncertain and really rather unstable. There had been some studies done in Oxford just before World War II about the effect of interest rates on businessmen's willingness to undertake investment, either fixed investment or inventory investment, which came out with very low estimates of the interest rate elasticity. So it was thought that the interest rate would have relatively little effect on expenditures. The one area where it was thought that it might be effective was on the balance of payments. So the way we sort of basically worked it was that you had a sort of iso-social welfare function, the bit of a black hole, so I can't put it up, which you tried to make tangential to your Phillips curve to get the best social welfare combination of unemployment and inflation. And you tried to move from where the forecast said you were to this best level of desired level of unemployment, giving you the best level of output and inflation by using fiscal policy. Now, if that, as it frequently did, meant that we had balance of payments difficulties, because at that time most people, particularly including Wynne Godley, were very concerned that income elasticity of demand for imports was much higher than the rest of the world's income elasticity demand for our exports, so that we were always likely to be forced to grow lower at a lower rate as a result of balance of payments pressures than the rest of the world, which was a comparison of UK growing much slower than most of the other developed countries that was regarded as very unattractive. But insofar as we tried to maintain our Bretton Woods exchange rate peg under conditions where we had a systematically weak balance of payments, what we did was we tried to set our interest rate relative to interest rates abroad to provide sufficient support to the capital account that we could survive the current account position that we had while maintaining the social welfare optimum equilibrium between unemployment and inflation. So that was the kind of world that we lived in the 1960s. And it wasn't a bad world. Unemployment was very low. By comparison with virtually any other period, output was actually growing quite fast. The problem was that output was growing far less fast in this country than almost everywhere else. And even the Italians, I hope there's no Italian here I'm offending, were growing at about 5% per annum, while we were growing at about 2.5%, 2.75% per annum, you know, let alone the Germans and the French. And the Japanese were actually light years growing faster than we were. And you know, there's a lot at the moment of what you might describe as envy about the rates of growth in Japan, in China, and in Asia. But it's much less marked, in fact, than the concern about the UK lagging behind all our near neighbours. That was very prominent in the 1950s and the 1960s. And that was one of the reasons, of course, why there was, when the DEA was set up in 1964 by Harold Wilson with George Brown, in which I worked, there was an attempt to provide a national plan. The problem with the national plan was that there was a huge hole where the balance of payments was supposed to be, and we never filled it. The UK never, ever managed to deal with this balance of payments weakness. And one of the really interesting pieces of policy discussion in those years were the discussions on whether we should strike out to have a floating exchange rate. What was known then as, it was known as ROBOT, after the names of those in the Bank of England and in the Treasury, who said we're so constrained by our pegged exchange rate and this is being so damaging to the rate of growth of the UK that we ought to do something totally different. The problem was that no one knew what would happen if we floated, and there were those who felt that if we floated it might just float downwards forever. One of the chief proponents of that was Sir Donald McDougall, who was actually the head of the Department of Economic Affairs. He persuaded, what was that scientist's name who was advisor to Churchill? That's right. That it would be too dangerous to float. And so it was never attempted. Anyhow, what we then ran into was the Keynesian analysis, which was pretty much dominant in the up to the mid-1960s. I got challenged by, first of all, monetarists, and secondly by Bob Lucas and the neoclassics. And Friedman's monetarism developed in the 1960s and challenged the Keynesian models on the grounds that the stability of the demand for money function was greater than the stability of Keynesian models. And there was a large number of articles on that. together with the development of the vertical Phillips curve and the importance of expectations. And the Phillips curve broke down, as you all know, at the end of the 1960s and into the 1970s. And the reason for that was that the economists working in government, on the basis of the Phillips curve and trying to choose the best social welfare point on that Phillips curve, had brought about a condition in which unemployment was pretty low, but inflation was steadily growing at about 3 to 4%. Now, when World War II ended, the general expectation was that deflation was much more likely than inflation. Again, this was partly arising from the Keynesian analysis that the marginal propensity to save was a positive function of income levels, so that as people got richer, they would save more and more, whereas the marginal productivity of capital would decline as the capital within an economy would increase. So over time, savings, the propensity to save would go up, but the incentive to invest would go down. So that there was thought to be an endemic likelihood that our economies would eventually run into massive deflation. And that belief that the real problem was to prevent our economies sliding back into 1930s type depression really held through until sometime towards the end of the 1950s. That may seem a long time to you, from the 1940s to the end of the 1950s, but remember, during that period there was the Korean War, and everyone knew that prices always went up during war times, and the Korean War was no exception to that. So that it was really only after the Korean War was over and prices still were going up on a fairly steady 3 to 4% per annum basis, that people then actually started to believe that inflation was endemic and would continue. So that until about the mid-late 1960s, the Phillips curve analysis, which was taken over the period from about 1890 to about, I think it was 1950, covered a period in which, exclusive of wartime, prices had been constant, and expectations were that prices would either continue to be constant or go down. So it wasn't until the mid-late 1960s that expectations of inflation became embedded into our system, that, of course, meant that since people wanted to achieve real wages and real profitability, that these inflationary expectations entered into their nominal wage and nominal price setting arrangements. And of course, when that happened, the Phillips curve moved outwards during the late 1960s and early 1970s. The economists working in the sort of treasuries, the Department of Economics and so on, and central banks didn't really understand that, and so we would re-optimize the social welfare function on what seemed to be the new Phillips curve, and that of course would drive inflation higher, and the Phillips curve would move out in the wrong direction, and we got stagflation. And that led everyone to begin to understand the importance of expectations. Meanwhile, Bob Lucas was criticizing, and correctly criticizing, the national income models by the National Institute model in the UK, the Treasury model, the models developed in America of various kinds, on the grounds that these structural equations had no micro foundations, and that there was a need for expectations which were at least consistent with the model and possibly rational, and arguing that agents should optimize over rationally expected future events, and that the models didn't do that. Now, of course, these kinds of micro-founded models didn't work fully at all. Again, there were various constraints. And I always used, when I was lecturing, which I no longer do very much, I always used to tell my students listening to my lectures that you, being students at Cambridge or LSE, can rationally expect that your average incomes over your life cycle will be in probably in the top 5% of the income distribution, which means that your average income will probably amount to something on, from nowadays for most of you, to in approximately in the region of, shall we say, £150,000 per annum. So why do you think that you're not actually consuming? You'll have a family later, so you won't want to consume £150,000 per annum every year, but you might at least sort of equalize over your life cycle and at least be comfortable and enjoy your time and spend £100,000 per annum. And so I said, well, you know, why don't you go to the bank manager and tell the bank manager that your professor has said that you're going to average £150,000 per annum, so can you please lend me £30,000 or £40,000 per annum? Actually, no, it's not all that far away from the student loan. The
current reality, yes.
Because the government is actually doing that for you. The government is going to loan you. Not as generously as, in fact, my suggestion. And the reason why the government may go some way in that direction, but the banks can't and won't, is because the government has got a much better ability, in fact, to enforce repayment than banks have. And that means that there's a constraint, because banks are not simply going to accept your say-so, that your professor has said that you're going to make this far greater sort of life cycle earnings, and so why don't you enjoy a bit of it now? And you are constrained, as many people are, I think probably on average in an economy, most people are constrained, by their income, plus whatever it is they can borrow. And whatever it is they can borrow depends on what they have to provide as collateral. So that the idea that you are simply looking at your total lifetime earnings and you're trying to optimize over that total lifetime in your consumption path is actually quite a long way from reality. Apart from the fact that people do develop habits, and generally people are much less happy to lower their consumption patterns. The sort of behavioral economics indicates that once you've got into a pattern of behavior, you're very keen to continue with it. So as a result, there's a much greater response of consumption to income levels in these sort of micro-founded life cycle models with Euler equations and all that, then it's probably realistic. However, we're now moving actually towards the present. Now, the optimizing agent model is actually quite complicated. You've probably seen it. You've seen examples of it. And how do you deal with the diversity of people, firms, and all that? And how do you make an optimizing agent model with optimization over lifetimes? How do you make it actually mathematically tractable? And the answer that has actually been developed is that you make assumptions that everybody is alike, a representative agent model, plus, and this is a critical point, there's a transversality condition. And what the transversality condition actually says, there's usually described as a no Ponzi game requirement, is that everyone always, with absolute certainty, pays off all their debts by whatever the horizon is, even if it's an infinitely long horizon. Now, that makes life a lot simpler, because you can then write down the optimization equations in far less. And in fact, the standard macro model still has exactly the same three basic equations, an expenditure function, a supply side function, and now a Taylor type reaction function that were pretty much there under the old Hicksian ISLM, though it's got somewhat fancier expectational format in the sense that your expenditures today depend on your expectations of where your income is going to be over future periods. Now, the problem is that the transversality condition, which says that everyone actually pays all their debts for certain, rules out default. And indeed, it has to rule out default. And that's the purpose of the exercise, because default is very difficult to incorporate into a DSGE model, because if you've got a representative agent model and the representative agent defaults, then the whole of the system collapses. It doesn't, it ceases to exist. So you rule out default. If you rule out default, then lending to any agent is riskless. So there can't be any credit risk premia. And in DSGE models, there are no credit risk premia. If there is no credit risk and everybody is riskless, you actually don't need any banks, because anybody can lend to anybody else with absolute safety. What's more, you don't even need money, because anybody's IOU is perfect. So that, say, I jump into a taxi when I take the train back from Cambridge to London, I don't have to pull out a pound note or anything. I just tell the taxi driver, I am now indebted to you. Now, and what's more, if I don't pay you, the interest rate will occur, and since I'm in debt, there are technical problems of how sort of everybody knows who's, how much their indebtedness is. But nevertheless, you see, your IOU is as good as the government's IOU, and the government's IOU is what a pound, or at least a £10 note or a £20 note now is. So you don't need any money. All you need is some sort of massive, great calculating machine in the sky, which actually tells everybody what their net debt indebtedness is at any one time. And as I said, there are no risk premia, so everyone pays exactly the same interest rates. Now, interest rates can vary over time, but they can't vary cross-sectionally because everybody has got perfect credit standing. So these DSGE models, which everyone has been working with, and really did come to dominate both modelling and macroeconomics, rule out virtually all elements of finance. It rules out default, credit risk premia, banks, money, the lot. And what really has been remarkable is that these DSGE models were used by central banks. And central banks' role is actually to control the money supply. And there is no money in DSGE models. And it's to worry about things like financial stability. And financial stability, I mean, the concept simply doesn't exist in DSGE models, because if everybody is perfectly creditworthy and nobody ever defaults, financial stability is assumed by definition. So that if you take the standard DSGE models of macroeconomics, 2007, 2008, and 2009 could not have occurred by assumption. It just doesn't exist. Now, in fact, these models are actually real business cycle models, because there is no money in them. Money gets introduced incorrectly because you assume either money in the utility function, and there's no reason why money should be in the utility function, because you don't need it, because anyone can pay by drawing an IOU on themselves, or there is a cash in advance constraint, and there is no justification of a cash in advance constraint at all. Because if everyone pays all their debts with probability 1, you simply don't need to have cash. in order to make a payment, right? It's just not necessary. So, essentially, these are basically RBC models, where shocks occur only to productivity and preferences, the standard RBC models. But what they do include is price-wage stickiness, with some usually Calvo pricing approach. So monetary policy in the forms of a Taylor reaction function, which changes interest rates, affects real variables. And the iconic book on this is Mike Woodford's Interest and Prices, 2003. Where there are no banks, there is no credit risk, money is included, but it is included, in my view, entirely incorrectly. One of the interesting issues is that in this kind of modern world, or rather the DSGE world, interest rate effects are entirely clear, while fiscal multiplier effects are totally uncertain. This completely reverses the way that everyone thought about it 40 years ago. I forget how old I am. Back in the 1960s, everybody thought fiscal policy was clear and well-defined, and the monetary and interest rate policy was very ill-defined. That is completely reversed. In fact, there was a paper given at the latest Jackson Hole conference about how, on the monetary policy side, we had a science, and we knew what we were doing, while fiscal policy was a lot of hand-waving, and nobody really knew what they were doing. So there was there's been a complete disconnect between macroeconomics, which has assumed no default, and finance, where the probability of default actually determines asset pricing. So this is actually my last slide. I think that it is beginning to be generally appreciated that we simply can no longer use the representative agent plus transversality approach to dealing with macroeconomics. And there's beginning to be a treatment of having a continuum of agents with differing risk aversion. So variations over time in default rates. And the models are beginning to adopt this. There's Woodford and Kurdier and Gertler and somebody or other, and Cristiano, Massimo and Rattagno from the ECB. And basically what they're now doing is assuming that corporates can default for a variety of reasons, which gives a purpose for having banks into the system. But most of these models don't have default within the financial system yet. They don't have banks getting into default. And there are now inclusions of risk premia into the models. One of the difficulties is to measure and model systemic risk. And there are a whole series of papers that try to deal with this. Brunemeyer and various co-authors like Peterson and Kovar, Viral Acharya and co-authors on systemic expected shortfall, and a whole the development. I'm not going to go into the monetary theory or Gary Gordon and the run of the repo, but one I hope that things that will happen will be that macroeconomics will start to reunite with finance theory. They've been totally separated, because macroeconomics has ignored default, and finance theory and asset pricing has very largely been based on assessments of the probability of default. And the two groups simply haven't talked together, and in future they will have to. So macroeconomics will change, is changing, hasn't changed anything like sufficiently, will need to change a lot more, and is in the process of doing it. And in a way, I think that will make quite a lot of the post-Keynesian analysis of incorporating elements such as behavioral theory, concerns about uncertainty. So you can't just assume that everything depends on probabilities which are relatively well-defined. They're not. and nobody knows what the future is going to bring. So that means that the Keynesian attitudes towards uncertainty, confidence, and all that, those kind of features, is going to come back. But there's a hell of a long way to go, because I think that the direction of macroeconomics, more or less ever since Bob Lucas got his hands on it, Bob is a remarkably able, and it's actually a function of genius, to be able to send macroeconomics in exactly the wrong direction for about 30 years. You have to be a genius to derail a major aspect of a major social science for so long. But it was a genius that I think actually drove the subject in exactly the wrong direction. And there were a lot of things. His criticism was dead on, that we didn't have any micro foundations, and most of the structural equations in the kind of models that we had were inconsistent and then sometimes totally implausible. But in order to try and correct that, I think that he moved the subject into a way in which the whole structure of the economy was set out in a way which was totally implausible, including the assumption that default would never happen. So there's an awful lot still to be done. Macroeconomics has got to change a great deal, and I hope that it will change. Yeah?
Thank you very much indeed.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how, to what extent macroeconomics does change to take post-Keynesian insights into account. But perhaps I could now introduce or ask Michael Kaczynski to respond to Charles.
Thank you very much. Great pleasure and honour. I'll start with a lecture I remember, which was actually Friedman giving the role of monetary policy in 1967, December, and he was just preceded a few minutes previously by Peter Oppenheimer, who was a sort of bright, sparky Oxford don at the time, who then said, well, really, economists are just like drunks. If drunks drop money in the dark, they go and look for it under the lamppost, because that's where you can see. Now, since the term was invented, macroeconomics has had serious problems. They were admitted by Hicks, who withdrew the ISLM model as soon as it became popular and repudiated it. It's had three basic problems, and one you've dealt with very well, indeed, it requires complete intertemporal markets, which basically means that in the end you don't need money, and therefore you get the Hahn problem, which is that the Rolls-Royce models can't deal with a major tool, basically. It's also had another problem, which is that economists don't like free parameters, which is largely why they don't like Keynes, because Keynes, and here I depart somewhat from what you said, Keynes really didn't suppose that prices were sticky. He had a very subtle and uncomfortable analytical device where he defines units, and he's very careful about saying that he's going to treat it all in terms of cost units. And the purpose of this is basically to be able to distinguish what happens to economic activity if you fix the cost unit, the wage unit, or the price level, basically, and then analyze what happens when you allow it to vary. And in the second part, he shows that if it varies, it doesn't help you. It actually only gets worse. And so it's a very difficult but interesting analytical device to show that, in effect, price flexibility isn't really the problem. The third basic difficulty, and here again I slightly disagree with you, the real problem with macroeconomics, which hasn't really been modified by any development since 1967, is that there's a choice between having micro foundations for macro behavior and macro foundations for micro behavior. And Keynes, of course, was actually much keener on macro foundations for micro behavior, which is why his consumption function is rather misunderstood, or has been pretty persistently misunderstood. I now want to deal with the actual thing very briefly, and that is what the last 3 years appear to have done. And I think they've done something very, very useful, and here I couldn't agree more. Until 3 years ago, there was a bit of Blinder and Bernanke, and there was Gertler, and various other people obviously thought that you ought to do something about banks and credit in relation to macro models, but it was never terribly successful, and in particular, it really couldn't deal with sort of stock flow problems or anything like that. It was nice toys. And then suddenly, bang, it turns out in a sort of beautiful illustration, which is really arises out of the fact that in this last crisis, half the world has recovered from the crisis very, very quickly. I mean, Africa, Latin America, anywhere where there hasn't been a banking problem or where they have known how to deal with banking problems is out of the crisis and actually growing at nice rates at the moment. And everywhere where they haven't known how to deal with banking problems is in a crisis. And this is established that in effect there's a very close interdependence between the national income multiplier and the bank credit multiplier. And this, incidentally, is something which Keynes pointed out in an article where he tried to explain what the general theory was about in 1937. You can spend all you like, but if firms can't finance their working capital, the national income multiplier stays dead in the water. And, of course, firms, largely small firms, finance their working capital through bank credit. So if the bank credit multiplier drops, as it sharply did with the liquidity problems, then the national income multiplier also drops, and there's a sort of interdependence, because as national income's going down, the bank's loans get worse, and therefore the bank credit multiplier stays down. So I think that that's an outcome which will not be possible to avoid that. That will be more powerful an ingredient in whatever developments come out of this. And I think it will also lead to interesting possible developments in econometrics, because econometrics hasn't been able to discover whether it's supply or demand that drives credit. They've never been terribly comfortable whether it's supply or demand that drives money, but credit has become completely elusive. It's a well-known identification problem. Now, the other big lesson, which I think is going to come out, and I note that there's somebody in the room who wrote a thesis on this particular point, and that is that we now know that central bank independence or money dominance or whatever you call it is a misnomer. It really is what we should call it is financial market dependence of the monetary authorities as opposed to fiscal dominance, in other words, financial monetary authorities' dependence on the public authorities. Now, I've got two more points. Am I allowed two more points?
Yes,
yeah. I don't know what caused the last 3 years. I have my own list. I think there are four culprits. The regulators, very obviously, the competition authorities, very obviously, a load of commentators, very obviously, and monetary authorities. It's perfectly possible that all of the above may become culprits again, but I want to make a special mention of monetary authorities. What's happened in macro management over the last 25 years, really since the crisis of the early 80s in the OECD countries, is that monetary policy has acquired a completely unwarranted burden of macro management. It's basically on its own. I can't avoid a little footnote on Keynes. Keynes actually has a very nice little thing on quantitative easing, as it's now become. He specifically mentions, but this is under normal circumstances, not under crisis circumstances, he specifically mentions that the monetary authority should not confine itself to the short end of the term spectrum, but should basically buy across the whole of the term structure, simply because we don't understand how the structure of interest rates moves otherwise. Just before concluding on how to lighten the burden of monetary policy, just for a second, I do want to say something about this poor, woebegone, wretched little model. It's getting so much stick at the moment, the dynamic, stochastic, general equilibrium. Because I think it's quite important to understand what the intellectual history of its dominance in central banks is. John Taylor studied what Greenspan used to say, which was a wonderful mumble, very, very, you know, oracular, right? And he managed to fit it quite convincingly to what was happening to... Right. That was stage one of the story. Then it was discovered, miraculously, that DSG models with a fairly standard sort of objective function and so on generate the same rule, right? And at that point, people who actually understood what Taylor was doing thought there was something in these models. But the models got in through the back door, and I frankly can't believe. I mean, you've got to distinguish between research departments and what the benighted central bankers themselves do. They may believe them when they're useful, but for instance, the Federal Reserve, when it should have actually applied the Taylor rule, which was in 2003, didn't. And as a result, we're now inheriting, well, we've inherited a bit of storm as a result. Back to my main theme. If you treat monetary policy as one of the culprits of the crisis, then one has to really revisit how it should be coordinated with fiscal action and with exchange rate action. Exchange rates are probably a bit too unstable, which of course adds to the instability of interest rates, which makes monetary policy and market activity all the more fun. And auto-stabilizers are inadequately stabilizing. That's to say, more investment should go into auto-stabilizers. In particular, auto-stabilization on the side of expenditure. I want to conclude with the opposite story to Peter Oppenheimer's story, which is recently, actually at the start of this crisis, a paper by Havelmo, which hadn't been published, was unearthed. And it ends with an amusing story, which is of two flatmates who've had a good night out and who come back to raid the fridge. And there's plenty of good stuff in the fridge, so they become philosophical and start asking themselves the question of whether the light stays on when the fridge door is closed. And then they decide that there's only one way to decide, and that is for one of them to climb in, and the other one closes the door. Unfortunately, macro theorizing has had an awful lot of that. I mean, the world's on the outside, and the chap's on the inside of the fridge. We don't know what's going on. I hope it's going to improve.